said, why did you call it Granny's Closet? We had no name.
Mm-hmm.
And but at my grandmother's house, if she had any toys or the Monopoly set or the baseballs or the bats, she would always put it in her closet. Not in her room, but it was underneath the stairway in her house. And we used to call that Granny's Closet.
Hello and welcome to The Climb, a show for aspiring entrepreneurs eager to learn about the beginnings, the struggles, and the roadmaps to success for life at 7,000 feet. This podcast will teach about the history of established business owners and entities in Northern Arizona. I am your host, Craig Moody. So if you're a business owner or a leader who wants to go to the next level, this podcast is for you. Today's guest is Mr. Martin Zanzuki, owner of the famous Museum Club on Route 66. In the 1980s, if you had ever frequented a Flagstaff nightclub, you knew there was a good chance it was either owned or ran by the Zanzuki family. The Zanzuki name is synonymous with nightclubs, musical entertainment, and restaurants in Northern Arizona. In fact, the Zanzukis have been tied to many historic bars in Flagstaff over the past five decades, including DJ's Lounge, Shaky Drake's, O'Shanigan's, The Lamplighter, The State Liquor Mart, Club 66, the famous Granny's Closet, and the Museum Club on Route 66. The common beverage for all these places is obviously alcohol. However, it was a non-alcoholic beverage that saw the Zanzukis get their start here in Flagstaff, and that beverage was milk. More on that in a second. Ferdinando Zanzuki and his brother Pio were born in Montelago, Italy in the 1870s. Just before the turn of the century, the two were able to board a ship in Juneau and come to America to seek work in the mines. They started in West Virginia and eventually made their way to Jerome, Arizona. However, Grandpa Ferdinando only knew the Italian language and quickly learned Spanish from the other miners. So he went back to Italy and found Ermelinda, married her, and returned to the United States. They took the ship right into Ellis Island in New York, and then eventually took enough trains to get back to Ash Fork, and then took their last leg to Jerome.
As time goes on, my dad always would speak highly of Jerome. He said Jerome was a hustling, bustling town. He said at one time they would house big-time boxing matches right in the open street. They would build a stage. All the hoorah toward the fighters would come in 2 weeks before time and train in the city square. He said it was like the biggest thing that ever happened. Dollars were being bet on the fighters.
Mm-hmm.
The fight would take place. The town was just, you know, it was just a big time in the old town tonight.
I can almost picture it from what you're saying.
Yeah.
So it's right where you top out there, where the street kind of separates.
Yeah.
That's pretty much the square.
They would build a ring right there.
Exactly.
And again, the fighters would train in the open air. And I mean, it would just create this magic, I think, to keep the miners occupied and happy and to keep them going underground to dig for copper ore.
Yeah.
And my dad would, he loved Jerome. That was where he grew up. But he talks about moving to Flagstaff. And at that time, the only way to Flagstaff, you could take the switchbacks or you could go through Prescott.
Mm-hmm.
And the family decided to load up the truck and drive. And they hired a fella to drive because my grandfather didn't drive too much. And as a matter of fact, they said my grandfather was terrified of the switchbacks. So he decided to walk up as a couple of, my dad says, I think my Uncle Paul rode in the truck.
Right.
But the rest of the family trailed the truck and just walked up the switchbacks to get to Flagstaff.
Wow.
And yes, the truck met him at the top of the hill.
I believe that. Yeah.
It was a one-way type thing. If you met on a corner, somebody had to back away and let the other guy pass.
Yep. That was the way to get to Flagstaff.
In around 1929, he buys the Flagstaff Dairy.
And where was that located?
The Flagstaff Dairy on our milk cartons, on all our advertising, it always says 3 miles west of town.
Okay.
Off Highway 66.
Right. Okay.
And it is where the current, if you turn off the highway at 66, you enter and you see the Coca-Cola plant.
Mm-hmm. Right there.
Right there.
Flagstaff Ranch Road in that neighborhood.
Exactly. Right. And that was the start of our dairy.
Okay.
And if you travel to the end of that road, you'll run into Flagstaff Ranch Golf Club. And so all of that at one time was a Zanzuki dairy.
Yeah. And that's Route 66. And it was probably in between Route 66 and what is now I-40.
Yeah. I-40 came later and dissected the property. Mm-hmm. Speaking of I-40, that was part of my uncle's success. But back to the Flagstaff dairy, my grandparents had a small dairy there. They probably milked less than 50 cows. And my dad's brother, Paul, was 2 years older than my dad. And my grandfather needed his maturity, his strength as a young man to work on the farm. So they asked my father to go to high school first and graduate. And so after he got out of high school, then my uncle Paul went to high school. So my dad got out of high school at Flag High in 1936. And my uncle Paul got out of high school in 1938. And backing up a little bit, my dad was put into special education because he couldn't speak English. So the people at Flagstaff school system, because he only knew Italian and Spanish, they put him in special education until he could learn the language.
Right. Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what they had to do back then.
That's what they had to do. Uh-huh. And so my dad graduates from high school, and then they put my uncle into high school, and my uncle gets out of high school in 1938. My uncle, right out of high school, joins the Arizona National Guard, and he becomes a fighting bushmaster. And he was in the National Guard from 1938 to the end of the war, 1946.
Okay.
Well, when World War II broke out, the Arizona National Guard was on maneuvers in Abilene, Texas, and the government sent them right to the Panama Canal to guard it. So everybody took off. Went to the Panama Canal. In Flagstaff, my dad was left to run the dairy with my grandfather. And the government gave him the ranking of 4F, which he was a farm kid. The dairy and agriculture was important to Flagstaff, so he couldn't go into the service. So that's when he became in charge of the Flagstaff dairy. Well, the government, in concert with the FBI, came out to our dairy and arrested my grandfather because he was Italian. They took his dynamite. They took his shortwave radio. They took his rifle that he had on the farm. Mm-hmm. And they confiscated that. And they took him and a German mason named Tony Koch. And Tony was a mason in Flagstaff. They took those two fellas down to a place called Crystal City, Texas, which was an internment camp. So left my dad and my grandmother to run the family farm. And it took about a year for them to get my grandfather. They found out that, you know, my grandfather was a peaceful individual. Mm-hmm. And the long story short is that the judge, the petition was written up with the bushmasters. And my uncle was a sergeant in the bushmasters. He sent a petition around to all the guys about getting his father out of internment camp. The guys all signed it, sent it into Flagstaff. They gave it to the judge. The judge ordered the bushmasters to be in charge of Mr. Zanzuki if he gets out of jail, that they would be responsible for his actions. So they sent the bugler down to Crystal City, Texas to get it. And the bugler happened to be Vic Nackert.
Really?
Yeah. And Vic Nackert said, you know, I knew your grandfather from Flagstaff. I mean, he only spoke Italian, so I couldn't talk to him. So my dad was left at the dairy in the 30s to be the milkman of Flagstaff, mm-hmm. which he did.
Right.
And they milked the cows. They pasteurized the milk. They packaged it in bottles or cans. And they ran it into Flagstaff, which we had a lot of the restaurants, home delivery. And that was our life from 1938 to when my dad sold the dairy in 1980.
Mm-hmm. So restaurants, the grocery, university.
Grocery stores, the university, the high schools, door to door. It was so common in Flagstaff for us to run milk into people's house in the wintertime. Mm-hmm. I mean, they'd leave the back door open.
Right.
And the instructions were just go in the back door, find the kitchen, put it in the refrigerator, and just tiptoe out of the house.
Wow.
And as you know, Craig, we both commented on the weather today about how raw it was. Days like this, I always think of my dad getting up at 4 a.m. and going out and loading his milk truck, heading into town, and it was all outdoor work.
I mean, right.
Delivering milk door to door to the grocery stores. But through that, he became, he ended up knowing everyone in Flagstaff, and everybody seemed to know him.
Right.
And there was a point in time when World War II broke out. My dad ran around with a sheep herder in town, a guy named Pete Espiel.
Mm-hmm.
And the Espiels are a very popular sheep herding family in here.
Yes, so, they are.
Well, Pete Espiel and my dad went to the museum club. And Pete Espiel saw this gal on the far side of the bar and asked her to dance. And she finished the dance and she asked Pete Espiel if he would introduce her to the shy milkman. And so Pete Espiel did. And my dad ended up marrying my mother 6 months later.
Your mother, Sally, who she came from New Mexico, as I understand it.
Yeah. My mother, she was Texan.
Mm-hmm.
And their family migrated from Texas into New Mexico. And my mother was truly a rootin' tootin' cowgirl from Reserve, New Mexico.
Reserve, really?
Yeah.
I know where Reserve is. It's beautiful country.
It's beautiful country.
Yes. Yes, it is.
And so they settled down. They lived at the Flagstaff Dairy from 1941 to 1950. But as my folks had children and the kids were all going to Nativity School downtown, St. Anthony's, it was called,
right,
in downtown Flagstaff. And
where did you guys live?
Well, we lived at the dairy.
Okay.
But my folks were having to haul my older brothers. And they were hauling them into town. So my mother found a real estate agent. Her name was Rita Quackenbush. And asked Rita if she could find them a house close to the church and the school. And Rita Quackenbush found the White House that we still own today.
Right, the White House.
At 215 North LaRue.
Right across the street.
Right across the street from the church and the school.
Wow, so you guys were right there just walking across the street.
And so we watched downtown Flagstaff develop. On either side of our house at 215 North LaRue were homes.
Right.
Across the street from our house were homes. And we saw them one at a time, you know, being lifted, the ground scraped, and all of a sudden a commercial building. Or in those days, Babbitt's Thriftway moved in right next door to us.
Yep.
But all of these places had their advantage for us as kids.
Right.
Because
Can I interrupt you? What year was that?
So my folks bought that house in 1950.
Okay.
And that was the same year I was born.
Okay.
So.
And you were number what?
I was five.
Five
out of 11.
Out of 11. Exactly.
And so as kids, you find fun ways to in your environment. And one of the fun ways we found was across the street from us was DES building. But they didn't work Saturday and Sunday, so they had this big empty parking lot that we used as a football field.
Mm-hmm.
And it was common for friends and people from Nativity School to come over and play pickup games in that lot. One of the cool things in our life was our folks got one of my older brothers a weight set for Christmas. And it was good. We had 110-pound weight set. And as we grew up, we needed more weights and more weights and needed more space and more space. So we cleared out one of the garages at our house. And since then, I mean, we had two weight sets and we bought a couple of Olympic weight sets. And we built this full-blown gym out of the back of one of our garages. And it was so modern at the time. And at the time, I mean, the early 60s. That you would find most of the kids from Flagstaff High School working out in our weight room. And you would find a lot of the kids from NAU that were into weightlifting, because in the 60s, it wasn't that popular.
Right.
But there were a few people would ask the question, where is a good gym in town? And they would send them over to the Zanzuki's Alleyway Gym.
Mm-hmm.
And that weight room is still there.
Is it?
And there are some of the people that you had mentioned that you've interviewed, guys like Mike Lovin. I'm sure that they spent a few nights working out in that gym.
Oh, absolutely. I wouldn't be surprised.
No, it was just the kind of spot in Flagstaff where there was no other place to go.
Right. And was it in the basement or was it in the main level?
No, if you ever go behind our house,
right,
there is a garage and it's attached.
Correct. Okay, it's in the garage.
Yeah, gotcha. It was just right in the garage. And it was
So they would walk down the alley and just walk in, and it would be open. And
exactly.
You guys have music going. And
oh, yeah.
We had lights. And
music, lights. It was open at nighttime. Mm-hmm. There was always a lot of action. And in those days, I like to call it the golden years of Flagstaff High School sports. And we're in the 60s.
And it was just Flagstaff High School. And I believe the population was in the high 20s at that point.
Wasn't that big.
It was
just like that, about that big.
Uh-huh.
Winslow.
5,000.
Winslow was could have been a little smaller, maybe a little larger. Because Winslow built a roundabout for their railroad workers. Mm-hmm. And it just drew all the railroad people. I've heard stories that the fathers of Flagstaff had an opportunity to put that roundabout in Domey Park.
Uh-huh.
But Tim Reardon and some of the lumberjacks said, you know what, we're asking for trouble if we bring a bunch of railroad workers and a bunch of lumberjacks into this town. We're just asking for trouble.
Right.
So let's allow Winslow to take that roundabout, and we'll keep with the sawmills.
Interesting.
Yeah.
That is really interesting. Yeah. So as you grow up, besides lifting weights and everything, what type of sports did you actually play?
Well, my father was a little league coach for 25 years.
Okay.
In the back of his milk truck from April through July, he would always carry the equipment bag. And all of the boys played on his baseball team. They were called the Mets.
Mm-hmm.
And we were always, you know, one of the top three teams at the West Flagstaff Little League. So all of us played Little League baseball. We all played football. Most of us were on the wrestling team because we just weren't able to play basketball, too short and slow.
Okay.
So we were all wrestlers, and that's what we did. And my folks were so great that they would attend every high school game. So my father, since my oldest brother entered high school in 1958, and he went to every away game.
Wow.
Wherever it's played, it could have been played in Jerome, Mingus, could have been played in Winslow, Prescott, down in Phoenix. He would get off the milk truck, get in the car, pile everybody in, and drive and watch that ball game, and then drive home that night and get up at 4 in the morning.
Sleep a few hours. And drive out to the dairy.
Yeah, and load his truck and do the route.
Wow.
And on Saturdays and Sundays, kids at the house would help him. I wanted to say one thing about this house. The Dolan House, as we always called it.
Correct. We're recording from the Dolan House.
Yeah, right. We're recording from the Dolan House. Mr. Dolan was a good Catholic. And in front of the Nativity Church, there was a sign that said reserved for Mr. Joe Dolan. And he would pull in his long car and park there and go to Mass. And he had his own pew.
Uh-huh.
And Mr. Dolan on Sundays would get in his car after Mass, and he would drive down the street to the Gables restaurant. And in the back of the Gables, there was a sign there, this pot, smoking pot, is reserved for Joe Dolan.
Really?
But Joe Dolan, and it was called Arizona Lumber and Timber, mm-hmm, they were the largest landowner in Flagstaff. And they owned all the property from the railroad, from the underpass in downtown Flagstaff to Interstate 40 underpasses.
Basically all of Milton.
They owned all of that. Mm-hmm. And when we bought Granny's, we paid ground lease to Arizona Lumber and Timber. And everybody did. Everybody paid a ground lease. Of course, there's NAU that worked, you know, that bought their property outright.
Correct.
But the Jack in the Box and the Dairy Queen and all these people, mm-hmm, as you go down the road, they all paid ground rent to Arizona Lumber and Timber.
So moving on, you graduate high school.
I graduated high school in 1969.
Okay.
And I went down to Mesa Community College and played 2 years of football at Mesa Community, and came back up to Flagstaff, did a semester at NAU, and my brothers, I have Hank, Matt, my cousin Paul, and myself, acquired a cocktail lounge in East Flagstaff called DJ's Lounge.
DJ's.
And I was about as far from country music as anyone could be. And that was a throwback country bar to where every song on the jukebox was a Tammy Wynette song. Mm-hmm. Or, I mean, you couldn't find a rock and roll song on there. The clientele was a very tough country western crowd. And I met the fella that gave us the keys that owned the building. His name was Jack Grant. And Jack Grant was a very colorful figure in Flagstaff. Jack Grant owned the Branding Iron, where CAF Radio is now. He owned a hotel and restaurant called the Branding Iron. He owned all the cigarette machines and all the pool tables in town. And he was into this bar, and it was called Don and Jack's DJs.
DJs.
And Jack decided, hey, I can't do this bar scene anymore. And he found, actually, my brothers would hang out at his bar. And they go, boy, this is a tough bar. It needs some tough kids to lay down the law down here. And so we accepted the challenge and got into the bar business in 1972.
Okay.
And out of the dairy business. And my father kept running the Flagstaff Dairy from 1972 to 1980. So in 72, it was good. We really turned the bar around. It was a busy bar. And there was another friend of Jack Grant's. His name was George Knackert, who we knew. Mm-hmm. We went to school with all his kids.
Yep.
And George approached us and asked us if we wanted to take on a building that he owned. And the place was vacated. And it is at 110 South San Francisco, where the historic brewery is.
Okay.
And it's a really nice building.
It was.
And leased that from George. And it was called, we named it Shaky Drake's. My cousin, his name was Paul. His middle name was Drake.
Okay.
And his hands shook a lot.
Okay.
You know? So we That's called it Shaky Drake's.
Shaky Drake's.
And Shaky Drake's was around from probably 1970 to 2000.
Mm-hmm.
It was opened up as a rock and roll bar. And we would have live music in Shaky Drake's.
Yep.
Tuesday through Saturday. And Flagstaff in those days had a really good music scene.
Yes.
I mean, in Flagstaff, we had two really good rock bands. And we would alternate each week with the different rock band.
Mm-hmm.
But they would work. I mean, this was their full-time job, Tuesday through Saturday. And then we kind of spread out and started hiring bands from Tucson or Phoenix, traveling bands.
Mm-hmm.
One of our highlights in our career at Shaky Drake's, or our longevity career at Shaky Drake's, was the Rolling Stones was going there. They were doing 50 states and 50 nights.
Oh, wow.
And this was back in the early 80s. And Danny Zalesko out of Phoenix called us. He said, the warm-up band for the Rolling Stones was supposed to play at NAU. And NAU, it's too close to finals, so they canceled them out. And I'm looking for a venue. And the band was called George Thorogood and the Delaware Destroyers.
Really?
And I had never heard of them. I go, yeah, well, okay, well, you know, we'll buy the act. He says, trust me, you're going to sell out in 10 minutes. We put it on the radio, and he was right. We sold out 300 tickets in 10 minutes.
300 tickets. So you could, the fire department said 300.
300 is your max. Mm-hmm. And I mean, we sold out right away.
Wow. But, I did not know that story.
Yeah. But in Shaky Drake's, I mean, we had all different activities.
Uh-huh.
We had barroom boxing.
Yep.
We had acts like George Thorogood. We had War in there.
No, really?
A band called War. I mean, we just had a number of shows passing through town. I mean, mm-hmm. that was.
Yeah. You had those shows. And then I know the Dome would have shows up at the Big Sky Dome.
Yeah.
At NAU Sky Dome. Yeah, so that was very interesting. I, too, was, you know, one of your patrons back then. I saw a concert or two at Shaky Drake's. Yeah, not much. But yeah, I just when I first started there, I lived actually in an apartment right behind it.
Okay.
So, yeah.
Easy access.
Yes, easy access. Well, a stumbling distance, we called it.
I got you.
Although I was never overserved there. So,
so Shaky Drake's, I think we opened it in 73. We did so well at Shaky Drake's that the Lumberjack Cafe came open, which is right down the street here on Milton Road.
That's Martin Zanzuki, owner of the famous Museum Club on Route 66. Coming up after the break, we will hear how a tragedy ultimately led Martin to the ownership of the Museum Club. Stay tuned, I'm Craig Moody, and you're listening to The Climb.
Allure AZ Med Spa is your go-to for all things skincare, self-care, and relaxation. At Allure, we specialize in results-driven treatments that are designed to take your skin to the next level. Stop in for a free imaging consultation where we can assess your skin and tell you exactly what it needs to make your skin goals come true. Whether it's acne, wrinkles, scarring, or dark spots, our highly trained estheticians can customize a treatment plan made just for you. Schedule online at allureaz.com today.
The Climb is brought to you by business coach and mentor, Craig Moody. If you or someone you know is a struggling small business owner who wants to go to the next level, I highly recommend you invest in a successful business coach like Craig. For more information on business coaching and mentoring opportunities with The Business Climb, visit his website at craigmoody.co. That's craigmoody.co.
This is Billy Cardasco from Babbitt Ranches, and you're listening to The Climb.
Welcome back to The Climb. I'm Craig Moody. So we heard how the Zanzuki staked their name in Northern Arizona.
My grandfather died in 1957, and he died of pneumonia. And they tried to revive him and save him, but on the autopsy, they found out he only had one lung.
Really?
And to the best, they figured that maybe somewhere in his mining career, that he lost a lung. But you would think that would be something you would share with your wife. Mm-hmm. But even my grandmother never knew that he had that operation and that his lung was taken out.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, that's just crazy.
Yeah, thing. That is very interesting. Yeah, so jumping back to where we're at. So Shaky Drake's, we're having a lot of concerts with some of the bigger names were George Thorogood and the Destroyers. War.
War was another one. Craig, we did really well at Shaky Drake's. The drinking age was 19 years old.
19, correct.
It was Vietnam War. The old motto, if you can send our kids to war, they should be able to drink when they get out.
Right.
And so NAU, which was always a suitcase campus, a lot of the kids started staying around town because they could go to the bars. You know, so all the bars had weekend business. And from Shaky Drake's, we did so well that we ended up buying the Lumberjack Cafe, donating the big lumberjacks to NAU, which sit in the dome and sit. I think both of them are at the NAU dome these days.
Yep. I believe one's outside and
one's inside.
Yes, correct.
Yeah. Kind of a funny story is there was a very popular bar in Phoenix. It was called the Bum Steer. And they had a bar in Tempe, Arizona. Well, they had put money down on the Lumberjack Cafe when we heard about it. And one of our liquor distributors came in and said, hey, you guys, the Bum Steer's coming to town. And we thought, oh, man, if they come to town, they're just going to put us under. So we knew Bob Morrison, the owner of the Lumberjack. We explained the problem. And Bob Morrison was good enough that he gave the money back to the Bum Steer and said, I'm going to go with the local guys.
The local boys.
And, yeah, right. And he sold us the business.
Right. Which is now become known as?
As Granny's Closet.
Granny's
and,
Closet.
And yes. You asked the question, you said, why did you call it Granny's Closet? We had no name. But at my grandmother's house, if she had any toys or the Monopoly set or the baseballs or the bats, she would always put it in her closet. Not in her room, but it was underneath the stairway in her house. And we used to call that Granny's Closet. And that represented a fun activity for us.
Right.
Because when my grandfather died in 1957, my mother and dad would always drop one of us at the dairy and ask us to keep Granny company. And we would spend the night out there.
Okay.
And she would tell us, well, go to Granny's Closet and get your Monopoly board or your little baseball game or, you know, your baseball mitt or whatever. So that represented a kind of a fun little place for us to, you know, to explore and keep our games and stuff like that. So it came out to where, hey, how about calling it Granny's Closet?
That's a great name.
Yeah. And so all the guys, our, you know, brothers, they went, yeah, that's good enough, you know.
Absolutely. And you know, the misconception is that your mom was Granny, you know, I mean, which that's not true. That's not, she was not named after your mom, but your mom really became,
she became
the centerpiece of Granny's.
Yeah. There was so we built and bought Granny's in 74 and we opened it in April of 75. And I tell you what, Craig, that April it snowed every day. And every day I'd go out in front of the building and it's snowing. And snowing. It snowed every day in April.
Wow.
And you're trying to launch a restaurant, discotheque. But it took off. Mm-hmm. It's part of it is we had that discotheque. And the discotheque became quite a place for college kids to go dancing and is stuff like that.
Yeah. It became dancing. And then you put TVs in there and started doing sports. And
well, before that happened, and this is about 1976, is that we have four parties involved in Granny's Closet. And we started having a conflict of how we should run the place. And we just couldn't resolve it. And that is with my brothers, Hank and Matt, myself, and my cousin, Paul. And it just got to the point with, hey, you guys, instead of fighting all the time on if we're going to sell a drink at $1.25 or a dollar, why don't we just split the sheets and go our separate ways? Proposition was made, why don't half of you take Granny's and then the other half take DJ's Lounge and Shaky Drake's? And we said, you guys choose. You choose. And they chose to take Granny's, which I would too. It was a beautiful place.
Right.
They were buying the ground. I mean, they bought the building. They were paying rent to Arizona Lumber and Timber on the ground. And so we split up at that time. And myself and my cousin went to Shaky Drake's and DJ's Lounge. I took over management at DJ's Lounge in East Flagstaff. And I was at DJ's probably for 6 years. And it was tough. It was tough because we had after hours on the weekends till 3 a.m. Mm-hmm. And we had opened up every day at 11 o'clock. Mm-hmm. So you'd close the place up. 1 hour to get out of the place, that's 4. And you have to be there at 11 o'clock to open up, go to the bank. It was a grind. It was tough. It was. In the meantime, we decided to open up a liquor store. So we rented more space from Jack Grant. And this is out at Kachina Square.
Kachina Square. Okay.
And so we rented the spot next to us and we put up what was called State Liquor Mart. Mm-hmm. And it was great. It helped us out because we could buy a large quantity of liquor and then distributed to Shaky Drake's and DJs. And it was called power buying. So we'd buy it at a better price and distribute it
by ourselves. Bulk.
Yeah. Buy it in bulk.
Wow. And where was DJ's at?
DJ's was right on the corner, right on the very corner. I don't know what's in there now. It was University of.
Yeah.
Right, it was right on the corner. I mean, we owned
So DJ's was there, and you know, it eventually became, I think it was Bunhugger's East at one point.
And that's who we sold it to.
Yes, okay.
But we owned the marquee. We would put clever little messages on the marquee, and people would get laughs. And one of those clever little messages was directed to the historic football coach, Emil Nasser. Mm-hmm. And Coconino High School is playing a big game against Winslow Bulldogs. The Winslow team drives up Route 66, Santa Fe Avenue, and stops at the stoplight right in front of DJ's Lounge. And on the marquee, it says, good luck, Coach Nasser, and you're fighting Winslow Bulldogs. And he told me about that. I mean, every time I see him, he says, Martin, I still have to laugh because the bus driver says, hey, Coach, I think they know you're coming tonight. And there's his name on the marquee lights.
That's great.
It was so cool. But that was the kind of fun you had to do in order to make it through the, you know, in the bar.
You had to have a distraction, I would say.
Exactly.
Absolutely.
Exactly.
Yeah, I remember, you know, frequenting your bars and, yeah, it was, you know, I I'm a businessman too. The two things I've never entertained is food and alcohol. I'm not a great cook, and not my DNA. I'm more of a service industry type guy.
Yeah. Well, but, I tell you, in the bar business is good. Mm-hmm. It's tough, but the food industry is a grind.
Yes.
Is a grind. So after DJ's Lounge in 1978, my cousin and myself acquired the Museum Club. And we acquired it through a flip of a coin, and we lost.
Really?
Yeah. The owner of the Museum Club, a guy by the name of Don Scott.
Mm-hmm.
And Don Scott played the steel guitar for a traveling band, Bob Wills and the Texas Playboys. And Don Scott came to Flagstaff in the 60s and told Bob Wills, he said, I need to raise a family. There's a club in Flagstaff I'm going to buy, which he did. And he went from 1960 to about 1977, and he ended up shooting himself in front of the fireplace.
Wow.
And a gal by the name of Barbara Mandrell, and the Mandrell sisters are the ones that were playing at the Museum Club. And they played a Friday night, and they were supposed to play Saturday night, and they couldn't get into the building. Called the cops. Cops broke open the door and found Don Scott in front of the fireplace.
In front of the fireplace.
Yeah.
Wow.
And so I didn't know that story. The owner of the building was the Seiler family. Seiler Homes. They owned everything.
Seiler Homes.
Seilers owned from the Crown Restaurant to the corner, which was where Jack in the Box is, Fanning Drive. They owned all that piece of property and behind. And the homes behind are called Seiler Homes still today.
Yep.
So we wanted the bar. A fella named Bill Weisel, who owned the Napa dealership in downtown Flagstaff, he wanted the bar. So Walt McDonald, who was married to a Seiler, flipped a coin and we lost. So they put Bill Weisel in the bar. And Bill, to his success, he had all the townspeople going to the Museum Club.
Mm-hmm.
But Bill became his own best customer. And Bill, toward the end, he locked himself in the building. They shut the power off on him. The water off on him, and he literally drank all the inventory in the building. We went to his dad at the Napa dealership, which was downtown. It's called Arizona Sound Pro now.
Mm-hmm.
That used to be the
Napa.
Napa dealer. And the owner of the liquor license was his father. And we explained to Mr. Weiss and said, I don't know what happened to Bill. That's not our business. But I guess the only way to get Bill out is if you sell the license to us. And we can work a deal out with the McDonald's Seiler family. And he agreed. So he sold the liquor license to us. And we slowly had to get Bill out of the building.
Mm-hmm.
And once we got Bill out of the building, we cleaned the place up.
Yeah.
And it became a kind of a country rock nightclub. So at that time, we had the Shaky Drakes, DJ's Lounge, the liquor store, and now the Museum
Club. The infamous. And so before it was that, how did it become, the zoo? How did it become, what was it? Was it taxidermy? What was it?
The Museum Club has a great history. And I didn't find it out until I started actually managing the Museum Club, which after we bought it in 1978, I kind of moved into the Museum Club and started running DJs in the Museum Club.
Okay.
Two country music venues. And I started discovering the history of the place. And the more you're in the Museum Club, and the more I found old photographs of the building going up. I found the owner's name that built the place, the contractor he used to build the place. I was just in love with the place. It was like this old house on television where the guy just keeps pouring more money into it.
Mm-hmm.
And we were busy,
yeah.
But we just kept fixing it up. And down the road, there's a race car driver that was out of Williams, Arizona. His shop, his fan club was out of Williams, Arizona. And it was Jeff Jordan, the NASCAR guy, Jeff Gordon.
Mm-hmm.
And Jeff Gordon entered a contest that said, in Car and Driver magazine, it said, top your top 10 roadhouses in the United States. And Jeff Jordan wrote an article about the Museum Club.
Really?
Because he came through town all the time to go to William. But Jeff Jordan wrote the article, and it appeared in Car and Driver magazine. And I just so happened to see Peggy Pavlich at a Christmas party. Mm-hmm. And I told her about this. And Peggy at the time was into public relations. And tell you, Peggy Pavlich is, I could only describe, her husband describes her as General Pat.
Yes.
When Peggy Pavlich is on to something, mm-hmm. she goes for it.
She is focused. And
she's
a good friend of mine.
Yes. Yeah, she is great. Well, Peggy Pavlich is the one that really took the Jeff Gordon article mm-hmm. and turned it into bigger than life. And at the time, we had a lot of Phoenix news media that Peggy convinced to come to Flagstaff and do stories about the place. Mm-hmm. And the more we did stories, the more history we found. The more it was exposed to the Phoenix media and the national media, the more people started writing us stories mm-hmm. about their experience in the Museum Club. And case in point is the first lady inducted into the Country Music Hall of Fame, the very first woman. Her name was Patsy Montana, and she saw the Museum Club on CMT TV. She penned the letter about when she played at the Museum Club for Don Scott and her weekend at the Museum Club.
Right.
And that letter still hangs on the wall.
Okay, I was going to ask, where is that letter at?
It still hangs on the wall. But the gist of it was Don Scott told the entertainers, do not dance with the customers.
Right.
You'll only get in trouble. Mm-hmm. She said, I was there two nights. The same handsome cowboys would come in and ask me to dance. No. She said, the third night, I couldn't resist. But in the meantime, several other guys were asking me to dance. And I'd say, no. So the last night, she says, I decided to dance with this handsome cowboy. And lo and behold, somebody tapped him on the shoulder and just smacked him in the face, which started the whole place into a brawl because I was right in the middle of it. And she said, so I have a fond memory of the Museum Club, and I learned a lesson.
Yeah.
Is that never dance when you're a performer.
Correct.
and that letter hangs on the wall at the Museum Club.
That's a great story.
Oh, it was.
Yeah.
But with Peggy, she is the one that was instrumental in collecting all the pictures, mm-hmm. creating the story. And we went to the city of Flagstaff and put it on their register of historic places. Mm-hmm. We took that information and we went to the state of Arizona and put it on their list of historic places. And then the state of Arizona submitted it to the National Register of Historic Places, and it was granted. So now we are on the National Historic Registry. And it was because of Peggy Pavlich.
Wow. I didn't know that story.
Oh, yeah. She was a dynamo.
That is amazing.
Yeah.
She is. She's very focused, and you can see her kids have done very well. And
oh, yeah.
Oh, because of that. Yeah. So the Museum Club is, you know, gaining steam. It's gaining traction. You're bringing in, you know, lots of bands. You're selling, you know, packing it to capacity some weekends, most weekends, depending on the weather. Can you remember some of the bigger acts that came through?
At the Museum Club, we had a guy named David Bromberg, who was a kind of a big name. We had a lot of bands. Again, we hired bands Tuesday through mm-hmm. through Saturday. And one of the bands that we hired was Toby Keith's band. Mm-hmm. And that band's name was the Easy Money Band.
So Toby was the lead singer?
Toby was the lead singer. It wasn't the Toby Keith band.
No.
It was called the Easy Money Band. And so Toby, one Saturday night, I'm paying this guy, and he's a big guy. And I ask him, I go, hey, did you ever play football? And he told me, he says, yeah, I used to play semi-pro football out of Arkansas. As it comes out, I think his grandparents owned a bar in Fort Smith, Arkansas. And they let him play uh-huh. on the stage, and the rest was history.
Right.
So Toby Keith played there. You know, a lot of the names escape me about who played there.
Right.
But we had a lot of up-and-coming national acts. And the reason we were successful is down in Phoenix, there was a bar called Tooley's Country. Mm-hmm. And it was named...
I remember Tooley's.
Tooley's was a... It competed with Mr. Lucky's.
Was it in Glendale?
No. Yes, it was. Yeah. It was in Glendale. Mm-hmm. And it was a
George big, Strait used to go there.
Big spot.
Yeah,
big
it was... Spot. Yeah.
And Tooley's Country had a booking agent. And this booking agent found that if he could put the acts in Flagstaff and give him a gig in Flagstaff, that the route these musicians would take was they would go from Nashville mm-hmm. and they would play in Tulsa and they would drop down into Albuquerque, New Mexico. Mm-hmm. They would play Flagstaff. They would play Phoenix. And then they would turn around and work their way home. Mm-hmm. And so George Toby Keith's band may have played 2 weeks ago and all of a sudden he's coming back.
Right.
So the people that enjoyed his act, I mean, he was coming back in 2 weeks, mm-hmm. you know, yeah. and he could announce, hey, I'm turning around. I'll see you in a couple of weeks. Yeah. So that was a lot of our success is the fact that these traveling bands had these locations. Well, a lot of bands have knocked that off because the venues like mine, like the Caravan East in Albuquerque, mm-hmm. they're not that big. And these bands, they don't travel as much anymore like they did in the 80s. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's true. That's very true.
We had the Ozark Mountain Daredevils.
Right. The old bus days and the staying together. I think you're exactly right. Yeah, it's definitely different nowadays. But those guys, I mean, that's just what they had to do to survive and make it. And you want to go, you know, start working your way towards somewhere, get a couple hundred miles and set up and make money, break down.
Yeah.
Put gas in the tank and keep going.
Exactly. Yeah. And that was their life. Mm-hmm. And that was the life of the country music singer, as we found from the 60s when Don Scott had it all the way through the 80s. And it just seems like now that we don't have those traveling bands mm-hmm. that travel through Flagstaff anymore.
Right. So what was your personal life like back then?
I was single.
Uh-huh.
I met my wife, Stacy, at Shaky Drake's.
Okay.
And a funny story is I'm the doorman at Shaky Drake's, and this is probably 1978. And I look out, and here's this group of girls walking into the bar. And so I'm, you know, obviously young, so I card them all. And this one real cute girl, she's wearing wooden clogs. She has knee-high Argyle socks. She's got shorts. She's got kind of pedal pusher pants down to her knees. And she's wearing a Spanish bolo hat. And I card her. And she gives me an ID card. And the ID card says, Debbie Arroz. And I looked at this ID card. It looked a lot like her. I looked her in the eyes and I said, you know, Debbie works for me at Granny's Closet. And I think Stacy shrunk about 2 inches.
I bet she did.
And I gave her back the ID card. And I said, welcome, Debbie. And that was the first time we met. Uh-huh. And we've been together ever since then.
Oh, wow.
This upcoming year will be our 40th wedding anniversary.
Really? Congratulations.
Yeah. We were married in 1983.
That's Martin Zanzuki, owner of the famous Museum Club on Route 66. This interview with Martin was so full of amazing history and stories that we had to cut it into 2 episodes. That's it for today's episode, but be sure to head over to episode 2 now, where you find your podcasts. Today's episode was brought to you by the Museum Club on famous Route 66. Log on to their website at museumclub.net and visit their event calendar to see your favorite bands. Or maybe even get country swing dance lessons or book an event.
Thank you for listening to The Climb. If you like and find this episode valuable, please subscribe and be sure to tell us your biggest takeaway by writing a review on Apple Podcasts. You can also head over to my website, craigmoody.co, that's craigmoody.co, for all social medias, business, coaching, and mentoring, and to grab a copy of my books. While you're over there, please share your feedback, questions, or topics that you'd like for us to tackle in future episodes. Special thanks to Miss Daniela Werner and Jeff Rendell. The Climb is recorded at the historic Dolan House here in Flagstaff, thanks to Mr. Andrew Meyer. Our intern is Jamie Smith, and special thanks to Alu Apollo from Pod Curated for producing this week's episode. I'm Craig Moody, and be sure to tune in next week for a new and exciting episode of The Climb.